Hello and welcome to the New Zealand Initiatives podcast. My name is Oliver Hartwig and today we have a special guest here in our podcast studio. Welcome the Ambassador of Switzerland to New Zealand, Victor Wawryka. Hi, Victor.
Good morning, Oliver. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Now, I think I made a mistake in describing you and describing your job title because you're the Swiss ambassador to New Zealand, but to plenty of other countries as well. So what are your designations?
Yeah, I'm the ambassador also to Fiji, Tuvalu, the Cook Islands, Niue and Tonga.
That means probably quite a lot of travel in the region.
Yes, absolutely.
So delighted that you had time to come to our office for a discussion on localism, because as many of our listeners know, the initiative has long been engaged in the debate around localism. We have always talked about Switzerland as one of the model countries that we would like to learn from. And in fact, in 2017, we took our members to Switzerland on a delegation visit. And one of our delegation members at the time was Christopher Luxon. And the Prime Minister now is talking a lot about this trip. He's talking a lot about localism. And so we thought it would be worthwhile exploring this idea once again with someone coming from a localist country. And that's why you're here. So when you, as the Swiss ambassador, listen to New Zealand politicians talk about localism in our context here, what comes to your mind?
Yeah, first of all, it's true. Yeah, the localism debate is something that we follow very closely here, also from the embassy side, of course, with much interest. Also, every time I have the chance to see His Excellency the Prime Minister, he actually mentions the excellent experience he made during his trip to Switzerland back in 2017. So we try to build on that experience as well. But yeah, localism, you know, from the Swiss perspective, it's something that is really inherent to our DNA. You know, Switzerland's main features are federalism and direct democracy. And yeah, the Swiss are rather pragmatic and do not tend to be overly nationalistic on a federal level. So the Swiss national identity often manifests itself in a very localized way. So there you have localism. So this feeling of togetherness during votes, National Day celebrations, but also in town fairs, Saturday markets, and by engaging in associations. Swiss have a very high density of associations in all different fields, you know, sports, music, leisure, trade guilds, even associations of chocolate eaters, for example. So really any kind of activity is very organized in a local way, and there is an estimated 80 to 100,000 associations in Switzerland. So that really forms part of our national identity, this localized way of organizing oneself.
And so in some ways, New Zealand and Switzerland are not too dissimilar. I mean, you've been in New Zealand now for a bit more than a year, and you would have probably recognized a few similarities. There are some distinct regional identities around New Zealand as well. I mean, you would not confuse people from Dunedin with people from Taranaki. So we also have some of these institutions. We have Saturday markets as well. We have a very active civil society in New Zealand as well, and yet the politics are vastly different.
Yes, indeed. That's inherent to federalism and the way Switzerland is organized, you know, where state power is shared by the constitution between the federal government and the cantons and the municipalities. Each canton, for example, has its own parliament, its own government, its own courts and constitution. And the cantons, they have a broad range, broad scope in deciding how to meet their responsibilities in different areas which really are relevant to the people on the ground, in the area of education, healthcare, cultural affairs, police matters, for example. So even the cantons, they levy their own taxes and the municipalities, and we'll probably talk about that also. And then the municipal level, you know, which is organized also within the cantons, each canton determines itself the division of responsibilities between the cantons and the municipalities. For example, local planning, running schools, social welfare, that's all dealt with on a very local level. Mm-hmm. And also each municipality levies its own taxes. So yes, there are similarities, I would say, between Switzerland and New Zealand, the way public life unfolds itself in a very localized way. I observe that very often when I'm in touch with the Swiss clubs all over New Zealand. So they have a very localized way of getting their Swiss cultural activities organized. So I'm very happy to see that.
should probably put a few figures to localism in Switzerland just to exemplify it a bit further. Most New Zealanders who have never been to Switzerland would be surprised by just the numbers. So Switzerland currently has a population, correct me if I'm wrong, of around 9 million?
9.4 million, yeah.
Yeah. And you're geographically the size of Canterbury in New Zealand?
Exactly. We're about the sixth of New Zealand. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the last time I checked, you had, of course, the 26 cantons and just under 2,000 councils.
Yeah, it's about 2,100 municipalities. So each canton, yeah, determines by its own constitution how it organizes itself with regard to the communes or the municipalities. In some cantons, those communities have a lot of independence and authority, and in other cantons, they're a bit more centralized.
So by contrast, New Zealand, 5.1 million people, geographically quite a bit larger than Switzerland, but only 78 councils. So here we have two countries that couldn't be organized in a more different way. Now, I think what we also have to explain, I mean, you touched on it already, there are some things in Switzerland that are dealt with locally that in New Zealand are dealt with by central government here in Wellington. So one of the examples you already mentioned, the police, for example. In New Zealand, we have a national police force with a national police minister. How does it work in Switzerland?
Well, in Switzerland, of course, we also have a federal police, you know, that go after federal crimes like money laundering, organized crime. I mean, all these criminal activities that have to be dealt with on a national level, also with international implications, of course. But then on a very local level, police, you know, community policing is organized by the municipalities themselves. And depending on the canton, they have different bodies that operate that can be very diverse, you know, depending whether it's a rural canton with not much going on or whether it's a city canton, you know, like Zurich or Geneva or Bern, where obviously you need to have your police force a bit stronger.
But the police is organized by the cantons, and some of them are actually quite small. What's your smallest canton right now?
The smallest canton, I think, is Appenzell Innerrhoden, yeah, in the eastern part of Switzerland. I'd have to look it up, the exact number, but we're talking like 50,000 people.
And 50,000 people organize their own police system. They probably also organize their own education system.
Yeah.
They do all sorts of things locally, which in New Zealand are dealt with centrally by Wellington.
Yes.
How does that work? I mean, the argument we hear in New Zealand all the time is actually, well, we used to hear at least, let's centralize it. Let's use some economies of scale. In Switzerland, it's the opposite. In Switzerland, you do this very decentralized. But does anyone actually say this is not efficient?
No, it is actually very efficient because policy making is undertaken very close where it matters to the people on the ground. But of course, this is closely linked to also where the money is going and where the money comes from. So here we're again with a tax system, which is highly decentralized, which allows political communities to organize their own matters in their own sphere of competence.
Taxes are a good keyword because that's another major difference between New Zealand and Switzerland. In Switzerland, you have three tiers of income tax. You've got a federal one, you've got the cantons, you've got local income taxes. Can you explain just roughly how this works in practice?
Yeah, the Swiss tax system certainly reflects very directly the federal structure of Switzerland. As I mentioned, all cantons have the full right of taxation. Of course, except for those taxes that are exclusively reserved for the federal government. Also, there was a reform of the income tax system implemented in recent years that provided for a harmonization of some of the formal aspects of the various cantonal tax laws, for example, when it comes to the determination of taxable income, deductions, tax periods, assessment procedures. But the cantons and the municipalities still have significant autonomy for all the quantitative aspects of taxation, particularly with respect to determining the applicable tax rates. So the tax burden varies considerably between cantons, between municipality, but it's also a nice reflection of the different needs that municipalities, cities may have in a different context. And that all, this whole system actually leads to quite a healthy, also internal healthy competition between those different government entities.
And the differences can be quite substantial. I remember looking at an example, someone lucky enough to be on a 500,000 Swiss francs income and having a choice between Zurich and Zug could actually save more than 100,000 Swiss francs in tax by just moving 20, 30 kilometers.
Of course, yeah, but the tax burden is not the only burden, you know, that you have to deal with as a citizen. Of course, you have to look at what the housing markets look like, what the rents look like, what the prices for the mandatory health insurance are like. They're also different depending where you are in the country. So you have to make an overall cost analysis if you take these kind of decisions.
Because tax differentials are, of course, incorporated in the land differentials.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the differences are substantial and councils and cantons in Switzerland receive a substantial amount of all the tax revenue. I think when we did our trip in 2017, we looked this up and at the time, I think the Swiss Federation only received about 20% of a total income tax revenue and the rest actually stayed local.
Yeah, the federal treasury collects 30% of total tax revenue, the cantons 40% and the municipalities 30%. So that's the rough distribution of tax income distribution.
So the lower tiers of government are actually together better financed than the federal level.
Yes, in some aspects, mainly when it comes to, for example, infrastructure or building of schools. And that's again linked very closely to direct democracy and the way people can actually decide on where their tax money that was generated in their community will be used. So you have those town hall meetings and or votes. You know, the Swiss go to vote 4 times a year on all 3 levels of government. So it's in those votes where people can decide how the tax money is used, whether in the education, police, infrastructure field.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, what it then means for policy development. You may have seen that the New Zealand Housing Minister, Chris Bishop, just gave a speech to the Wellington Chamber of Commerce. And in that speech, he talked about incentives for local government to build more and to make it easier for people to build homes and other developments. In Switzerland, you already have that. So in Switzerland, when it comes to development, you wouldn't have to convince a canton or a council that development, housing development or business development is a good idea because they are often very much in favor of that because they benefit from it.
Yes, correct. But then again, you know, Switzerland is really completely built differently, the way it was built bottom up and not top down. So you can't really compare directly with New Zealand.
Is it then true to say that Switzerland never had any form of localism really or any form of decentralization? It's simply a matter of non-centralization to start with.
Exactly. In principle, this is correct, but there have also been attempts to centralize, of course, certain areas where the pendulum has swung back and where we're back into a decentralized form of organizing ourselves.
What does all of that then mean for the state of democracy and for the state of the media, for example? One of the things that struck us at the time of visiting your country was the sheer number of newspapers. I believe at the time there were more than 300 daily and weekly newspapers all around your country. And it was explained to us in a way that these newspapers are necessary because people need to make up their minds on local issues because they keep voting on them on a regular basis. And that's why there's a much more vibrant media scene. Is that true?
It's true to the extent that, yeah, every community, every region has its own newspaper that also highlights local issues exactly for this political, the opinion making to happen. So that's certainly a good thing. But of course, the reality is many of those local newspapers belong to 2 or 3 major media outlets, you know. So the diversity is there on the ground, but of course, also we see a large centralization happening in the area of media outlets.
But would you still say that fact that you're deciding on local matters locally actually leads to more vibrant discussions on public policy?
Yeah, and to a high degree of ownership in policy making. I mean, merely by the fact that the Swiss have to cast their vote 4 times a year on municipal, cantonal and federal subject matters, that leads to a high turnover in public debate on all levels of government. Yeah, for the federal government, it's mainly on national TV. On local issues, it's more in those local newspapers and in town hall meetings or public discussions that are happening. the beauty of the system is this high level of ownership of communities in political decision making.
And what kind of turnouts would you then get in these referenda?
Interestingly, the turnout is not that large. Usually we get a voter participation of about 40%, depending on the subject. There is only one canton that has mandatory voting, so you get fined if you actually don't go. But in all the other cantons and municipalities, this is actually not necessary. And 40% is actually a good reflection of participation, knowing that in Switzerland, on all policy matters, the people will have the final say. You know, we have these instruments of public referendum against laws and of popular initiative. So, you know, this direct democracy is steering also political decision making from the government side, from the political party side. They always have to take into account people's voices.
So you would be careful when it comes to lawmaking, because there's always the threat that if you do something really, really silly, it will just not survive the referendum.
Exactly. Or to put it the other way around, actually, any law that comes out of the legislative process in Switzerland is already the consensus and the compromises between different pressure groups, you know, that have worked in the elaboration of the law, of the piece of legislation, meaning that the whole process of legislating in Switzerland is rather slow, but stable.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the 40% turnout in referenda, but I assume that varies from referendum to referendum.
Exactly. Yeah. There are some referenda that get a bit more public interest, of course, you know, when, for example, whenever it comes to questions around Europe, Switzerland's relations with Europe are a bit complicated. We are not part of the European Union, but of course, we have a highly integrated economy with the European economy, so we need to make sure we have full access with the European markets. This is all organized via a set of bilateral agreements, but these agreements need to be updated. And we have to find new frameworks to operate in with regard to the relations with the European Union. And that's a complicated matter, you know, to reconcile our constitutional setup, federalism, direct democracy, with the need to actually be more engaged with the European partners.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about business development in Switzerland, because that was one of the things that really impressed us when we visited back in 2017. I remember visiting a factory of Stadler Rail, so the railway manufacturer, that's actually now present in New Zealand as well, of course, with loads of locomotives being used by Kiwi Rail. Anyway, we visited their main factory in Busnang in the canton of Thurgau, and it was impressive. It was a massive factory in the middle of a rather agricultural region, and one of our delegation members asked the owner of Stadler Rail, Mr. Spuler, how difficult it was to get consent for such a large factory in this beautiful part of Switzerland. And Peter Spuler, I remember, laughed at us and said, well, come on, I'm the biggest taxpayer here in the village. I'm the biggest taxpayer in the canton. You go figure. They love me here. How does it work in New Zealand? We turned around and said, well, actually, it's a bit different here. So this experience of actually councils and cantons working hand in hand with business on development, is that something that is the norm in Switzerland, or is this a bit unusual, this Stadler Rail story that we witnessed?
No, that's not unusual at all. That's really the norm, the way private sector and government and the taxpayer try to partner to get the best for the people, you know, in terms of tax revenue and in terms of labor or workplaces in a region. And as I mentioned before, there is sort of this healthy competition going on between the different locations, you know, for business development. So you often find, and that's also the role of the embassy, you know, when we get asked by companies where they should invest in Switzerland, then we lead them to our investment promotion agency, Switzerland Global Enterprise, and they will actually allow this shopping for the best location, you know, to take place. And then all these locations will show up, you know, to roadshows and then present all the benefits of investing in their respective regions. So that really works also from perspective, you know, international investor in Switzerland.
So when it comes to international investors expressing an interest in Switzerland and introduce them to your authorities in Switzerland, you will have 26 hands going up and saying, come to us.
Yes, well, not technically 26, because some of the cantons, they partner in larger regions, you know, just to make a collective effort. So there is an example of centralization going on. Like you have the region of Geneva, Bern, you know, partnering. Then you have the greater Zurich region. Then you have the Eastern Switzerland region. So they appear more and more as a regional opportunity.
But there is an enormous amount of competition then.
Yes, or it's almost like a beauty contest. You know, these regions, they compete for the best investors to set their foot in their respective areas.
And what's the role of federal government in all of this? Are they basically staying out of this?
Yes, that's very limited, actually. As I mentioned, there is this government-funded entity, Switzerland Global Enterprise, that tries to coordinate, you know, between the different regions. But it's really the cantons that have the say on these decisions.
You see, in New Zealand, we currently have a debate on so-called city deals. So the idea is for central government in Wellington to get together with individual cities around the country, say Auckland or maybe Wellington in the future, and arrange a deal where some functions of central government might be passed on to local government, where some forms of taxation might be passed on, but it has to be negotiated on a case-by-case basis. In Switzerland, meanwhile, that's just not necessary because they are autonomous to start with and they don't have to ask anyone for permission in central government.
That's correct.
And from a New Zealand perspective, you would look at that and think, well, how would that work? That would be very messy as a process, but you probably have a few hundred years of experience in making it work.
Yeah, well, in Switzerland, the whole thing grew sort of bottom up anyway. Switzerland became a federal state only in 1848, and before it was a federation of independent states. The cantons were very independent, except for a short period when Napoleon invaded Switzerland and created the Helvetic Republic at the end of the 18th century. That was only a few years, but apart from that, yeah, again, the cantons were the states which had all the autonomy until 1848, when some of the authority was transferred to the federal level. But of course, it's a back and forth, and the political process requires a lot of legislative steps to ensure solidarity, you know, unfolding between the Swiss cantons. For example, this tax system that we already talked about. Of course, we have a national equalization system. You know, the weaker cantons get supported by the stronger cantons. So even if you get all these nice investors from abroad, you will be liable as a powerful canton to make your contribution to the overall well-being on the federal level.
What does all of this then mean for the individual, for individual families living around Switzerland? What does it do for their position vis-a-vis the state? I would imagine actually that it gives them a lot more choice and perhaps a bit more power. Perhaps they are even treated more like customers of state institutions because they have to be nicer to them, because they could just move down the road and get a completely different tax system, for example.
Yeah, it sounds tempting to see that way, but unfortunately, the reality is, of course, people depend on the proximity to their workplace, on the schools that are there. Also, language is an issue. We have four distinct language regions, so also you usually stick to the language region that you were brought up in. So the reality is this mobility, you know, doesn't always play out well. Of course, in theory, the competition is there. And I've seen people move, you know, from one canton to another, hoping for a better deal. But as I mentioned before, that deal, you know, you have to make an overall cost analysis with all the pros and cons. And,
but does this competition have a disciplining effect on councils and cantons?
Yes, of course. I mean, those communities, municipalities that have a very low tax rate, of course, they do attract a high percentage of high income people, but that obviously has an effect on the housing market, you know, like we see in New Zealand, in Queenstown, I believe, especially, you know, with the house and the land prices going up. And then, of course, that affects the whole community. And then you have a pushback in those communities from sort of the middle income and lower income people through political means to balance it out, sort of.
Since you mentioned Queenstown, we have to talk about tourism as well. Because in Queenstown, I know, of course, there's this ancient debate about, okay, we only have, I think it was 15,000 ratepayers or something like that, but millions of tourists per year. And the tourists, of course, don't actually pay for the infrastructure that they use. And so for years, there's been discussion in Queenstown whether there couldn't be something like a bed tax or a tourist levy or anything else, really, to make sure that Queenstown itself gains something from all the tourism revenue that it generates. Switzerland, meanwhile, that would happen automatically.
Yes, I mean, to the extent that it reflects the federal and the municipal autonomy, you know, to decide on taxation and infrastructure. But in tourism specifically, Switzerland, or in most Swiss cantons, there is also a tourism tax that is levied on every night in a hotel. So that's also that something benefits directly the communities. But all in all, yeah, it's always the people that will have the last word. Even places in Switzerland that are affected by the so-called phenomenon of over-tourism, you know, of places like Lucerne or some of the mountain resorts, Zermatt, Crans-Montana, Gstaad, they're highly affected by this phenomenon of over-tourism. And then you see people pushing back also against all the negative consequences of tourism, and they try to find solutions when it comes to transportation, you know, parking space for the buses, you know, that invade all these smaller communities, and transportation solutions, and yeah, just making sure it works out for everyone.
But all of these solutions, again, are locally made solutions. You're not waiting for Bern to tell you what to do.
Exactly. Please behold, of course.
Okay. So Switzerland, as you mentioned, has grown to where it is today over centuries. So it's probably not something that could be copied easily. But what are the lessons that you think Switzerland might hold for other countries that are more centralized?
Yeah, of course, that's always a delicate thing. You know, we're not here to sell the Swiss system to anyone, knowing that it's very unique and it has worked for us and it still works for us. But that doesn't mean that similar solutions would work in other parts of the world automatically. But the sense of, you know, the beauty of decentralizing government authority, tax authority, is certainly something that has worked very well for our system. And this also couple it with the education system and something that we haven't talked yet about, you know, the vocational education and training system in Switzerland. Yeah, I mean, certainly the decentralizing character or this decentralized character of our state is a large success factor also in economic terms.
So, and when you are listening to our debates in New Zealand right now and you hear the name of your country mentioned again and again, and I think it's been mentioned also in conversations you had with the Prime Minister, what do you think? Do you recognize that this country is having a debate that might actually make us a bit more Swiss?
Well, actually, I find the New Zealanders are very Swiss, you know, in the sense that they're very open-minded. They like to debate also on a local level, and I've seen that visiting several communities all over the country. So there is a rich interest in political affairs here. So yeah, one would hope that the people are listened to more consistently also in this country. I have the feeling sometimes, or that's what I hear, you know, when I'm in the field, is that there is also a sense of a bit of frustration, you know, of people. Yeah, voting for parliament every 3 years, but then essentially having not much to say for the rest of those 3 years. So that doesn't mean that New Zealand would be best off, you know, to include more of those direct democracy lessons learned from Switzerland. Again, you know, that's something that works in Switzerland, but it wouldn't work elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, the debate is on, and Switzerland is always happy to share our experience and to see what it could be of benefit to other countries.
So maybe time for another delegation visit to Switzerland in a few years' time. And in the meantime, I believe that any politician listening to this is always welcome to check out with the Swiss Embassy here on what lessons they might want to learn.
Absolutely. Our doors on Custom House Key are always open.
Wonderful. Well, then, thank you, Your Excellency, Viktor. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with our audience, and we look forward to the further debate on localism.
Thank you. I'll be very interested to follow that debate very closely.
Thank you.